They still get a little.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the House Energy and Environment Committee. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, and welcome. As I mentioned just a minute earlier, there is an overflow room in Hearing Room F. If anyone here isn't able to find a seat, or anybody coming in isn't able to find a seat, so you're welcome to sit there. And just to talk a little bit about the agenda today, we are going to start off with House Bill 4037, and then the second bill we'll hear will be House Bill 4036. All right, so let's go ahead and we're going to open an organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting the committee rules. Representative Reardon.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2016.
Thank you. Representative Reardon moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2016. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the rules are adopted. All right. And let's go ahead and I will now open a I'm going to close the organizational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 4037. Beth, can you provide the committee with a summary of this bill?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4037 would direct the Oregon Business Development Department to establish a program to encourage the development of solar energy projects in Oregon with a nameplate capacity of between 2 and 10 megawatts. The project enrolled in the program would receive a monthly payment of 0.5 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity generated for a period of 5 years. There is a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and there is an OLA-2 amendment, which I believe the proponents of the bill will speak to.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I think first up we have David Brown. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is David Brown, and my company is Obsidian Renewables. I'm here this morning on behalf of House Bill 4037. You may recall that last year, House Bill 2632 passed this committee, and it was a bill that basically established a five-year program for supporting community-scale solar projects from 2 to 20 megawatts, and that bill would have run for about 8 years in total, and we estimated initially that it would support the development of around 450 megawatts of projects. That bill, while it was very popular, was unable to get through the last-minute choices that the Ways and Means Committee finds necessary to make, and I appreciate the hard work that the Ways and Means Committee members did, but we were advised after the session by leadership and several of you to propose a much, much smaller bill. And so 4037 is that much smaller bill. 4036 was state support of 2 cents per kilowatt hour. This is a half a cent a kilowatt hour. The prior bill was expected to support up to 450 megawatts. This is capped at 150. The prior bill was going to last for 5 years and basically be a policy. This is a bill that's expected to build the number of projects right now. So projects are expected. In fact, they have to sign up within 12 months, and they have to be built within 12 months after they sign up. So this is a economic development program that's going to result in projects being built this year, and then because the tax law was extended, trailing into next year. The total cost of the bill, by my estimate, we haven't gotten legislative revenues yet, is going to be about $5.7 million over 5 years, so a little over $1 million a year. For that, during construction, we'll get 385 full-time equivalent construction jobs, $31.5 million in property taxes over 30 years, $17.5 million in direct federal grants, $57 million in direct labor wages, $300 million in total economic activity and an ongoing 12 jobs in operations and maintenance. From my perspective, more importantly, it establishes experience in solar, which will allow the industry to take the next step. After this bill, you're going to hear a bill about changes in renewable energy policy, and I view this bill as kind of priming the pump in a way for getting Oregon the experience it's going to need to compete for having these larger renewable energy projects in the future located here. And then because of the intense interest, this time I calculated the effective cost of carbon on this bill. I used the portfolio rather than assuming it just replaces coal plants. And I used a 30-year life to calculate the cost of carbon because that's the life of these projects. And it works out to about $1.14 a ton, the way I figure the math, which is, I think, annotated in my testimony. And then after talking with many of you, most of you, and several other interested people, I got some suggestions on tightening up the bill further. And so there's an amendment, and the amendments do these things. First, ODO asked that we clarify that nameplate capacity is an alternating current, not direct current, which we have done. Second, this is intended to stimulate economic activity right now. So we made it clear that projects that have previously been built don't qualify because it obviously didn't need the subsidy because they already got built. And second, the projects, if they don't get done on time, if they start to get extended, then they lose their support, and if they don't get done within a year of when they said they would get done, then they lose the support altogether. So that prevents the program from being dragged out. Third, out of some concern that only one or two developers might benefit from this, we put a cap of 35 megawatts per developer group. And so those were the additional sideboards and protections that people asked for that we were happy to include in the bill. Of course, I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Bruton.
I really appreciate all your hard work on this. Could you just clarify for me what a developer group, how that is defined?
So that's going to have to be filled out in regulations. It's very hard to kind of get that right. But we've studied the issue at ODO, at FSEC, at the Department of Revenue, in several ways about who is a related party and who's not a related party. And I think it comes down primarily to ownership or to the definition in securities laws of an affiliate. So you're considered related to somebody if you control them, if you're controlled by them, or if you're both controlled by the same entity. So that means if it's your child, if it's your parent, or if it's your aunt and uncle. I expect that the regulations will be along those lines. Who's the underlying ownership group?
Okay, so some other point, it'll be worked out.
Yeah, the utilities face the same question when they try to decide if two projects close to each other are the same project. And so they have a similar who's behind these projects, who owns them. It's a complicated answer, but it's one that is addressed several ways already in this area.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative
Benz. Madam Chair, thank you for all the hard work on this bill. If 4036 passes, there's going to be a lot of green energy needed. We would, of course, want to see as much of that developed in Oregon as we possibly could. Does this bill, and I think you mentioned, make that more likely?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, thank you for that question. I also am very excited about 4036, and I've been very interested in seeing that a number of the projects are built in Oregon. The sensible response from a number of people is that they're going to have to be cost-effective here to be built here, and I understand that challenge. I can't overemphasize how little experience we have with larger-scale solar in Oregon at this point. So I have developed Oregon's three largest projects. That's over the course of 4 years, and two of them are 5 megawatts, and the third one's 2 megawatts. That's nothing. California does that every 5 days. I mean, Oregon has all in less than 100 megawatts of solar. Utah is going to build 800 megawatts this year. So we need to have experience so that we don't have lengthy hearings by planning commissions that have never seen a solar project before. So we don't have contractors who are all concerned about lots of uncertainties and have big contingency budgets, and all of which raises the cost, so that the process or development is shortened, so there's not as much developer overhead and time. I have projects. I have one that's just about to start that's been 4 years in development. We have to shorten that down so that we can drive down costs and be competitive. And this bill goes a long way towards giving us that experience.
Thank you.
Representative Hovey.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brown. I appreciate you bringing this bill back. And, you know, I know we talked about it. One thing I sort of overlooked in our previous question, I was kind of curious whether there was any oversight from the Public Utility Commissioner over any of these programs included in this. Do they have any authority on how this is put together and delivered to customers?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, no. I'm trying to think, and I was just looking up at the ceiling in case it was up there, if there's any part of this that relates directly to the PUC. And I think that all of this is coming from the PUC. That is, these projects that are about to be built are built under a law called PURPA, which the PUC administers. And so the rates that are being charged are all rates that are consistent with PUC orders. And so in that sense, the PUC has supervised the creation of these opportunities and these public avoided costs that the developers are paid. But they don't have any role in the actual financing or construction of projects.
Representative Benson.
I'm sorry. I'm sure I had a follow-up I should have asked. Perhaps I was assuming everyone understood the huge amount of money that would be spent under 4036 and the need to do what you're suggesting so we don't lose all that money to places like Utah or other out-of-state folk that would be more than happy to spend all of our money on their projects. So how much money is that? We're going to hear more about it, I'm guessing, in the next hearing. But this is your bill is a gateway to a whole bunch of jobs and a whole bunch of activity long-term in this state. How much?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, again, thank you. Thank you for that question. Let me illustrate the answer with a specific example. So we have a project that we're developing at the Lakeview Airport. The Lakeview Airport was built during World War II out of concern that the fleet of aircraft couldn't safely be at the coast, and there's airports in Lakeview, Madras, et cetera, all along the east side of the range. And those airports don't get much activity. There was a lot of land there because there were actually troops based there. So Lake County has owned the property at that airport since the Army demobilized after World War II. And except for a little bit of grazing, there's no taxpayer, there's no revenue associated with it. It grows sagebrush. So we're proposing a 320-acre project there. And first, it would give Lake County $200 an acre in rent. Next, it would give Lake County $1,000 an acre in property taxes. Third, it would give Lake County two jobs, which is not insignificant in Lake County, two full-time permanent jobs in maintenance and ongoing operations. Plus, there's the economic activity during the construction period, which is very substantial. So that's, I think, the magnitude that one of these projects can bring to a community.
Follow-up. Right, but how much money is going to be coming out of 4036 that we want to grab and keep in this state? My rough numbers were in the billions. Is that right?
Representative Benz, I don't know if Mr. Brown is able to answer that question, but I'm sure there's probably a panel with the next bill that will be able to answer that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They're appropriately alerted.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Boone.
Just a quick one. Thanks, Madam Chair. Hi, David.
It's Representative Boone.
Always good to see you. Are you working with any community colleges on workforce development specifically for this sector? And if so, are you, what is it, a new offering for the students? I guess I'm asking what kind of employee you're looking for, engineers or mini engineers or whatever.
Chair, very good. Peterson, Representative Boone. at Senator Bent's request, I contacted, I'm hoping it's Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, and went over and taught a class to their renewable energy group on solar and what it means to develop and build a solar project. The interest in Malheur County for solar projects was very high. There was a separate meeting with the mayor and a city councilor and just a lot of interest in how do we do this and how do we get ready. I'm happy to report that several of the projects that we're talking about are expected to be built in Idaho Power Service Territory, which is that area. And there also are several projects going to be built on the Idaho side of the border, so those opportunities will go from being prospective to being real. The jobs are electrical, experienced electricians. All of our jobs have been with the, and proudly with the members of the IBEW. And then there's ongoing operations and maintenance jobs. But there's also jobs for in welding, installing fences, delivering gravel.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Next, I'd like to call up Bill Eddy, Ricky Seguin, and John Molis, please.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, my name is Bill Eddy. My company is One Energy Renewables, and we're a Northwest-based developer of projects, basically exactly in the nature of what Bill 4037 will support. We focus on projects, solar projects in the range of 2 to 20 megawatts, and we work around the country. We have had some moderate success here in Oregon. But frankly, we've had more success elsewhere, sunnier places and places with different or better incentives. And we would very much like to invest more in Oregon. We've had one project recently completed actually in Polk County, about a 3-megawatt project. We have another project under construction down in Klamath County. And we're hopeful for another batch ranging up to about 40 megawatts for our company. I want to echo what Mr. Brown said. There's really only a kernel of expertise in Oregon when it comes to large-scale solar development compared to other places. And this bill will really give us the expertise and the founding to look at much, much bigger projects, projects that will compete for the larger investments that will be driven by the Bill 4036, the RPS bill, if that does pass the legislature and it becomes law. Secondly, we support it because it will ensure that some of that investment for the RPS, some of that investment period, happens in Oregon and also happens in places that you might not expect necessarily. There are certain counties in Oregon that are blessed with tremendous wind resource. But I would anticipate this bill resulting in projects going in the ground and being supported by the state in a diverse range of counties, Jackson, Klamath, and Lake. They're very sunny, obviously, but also Umatilla and Morrow and Malheur. So it's going to spread some of that economic development around, and it's going to grow our expertise. So I do want to support that bill. I also want to support the amendments that Mr. Brown outlined. I think they make sense. Keep the bill structured and confined so that it not just one developer group takes advantage of it. So we support the amendments. And I also want to register my support for the RPS bill, 4036. I won't separately testify on that, but for the record, we do support that as well.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. Ricky Seguin, I work as the State Director of Environment Oregon. Environment Oregon is a citizen-based environmental advocacy organization. We have over 40,000 members and supporters in all corners of the state. And short and sweet, here to support this bill. I know we've got a lot on the agenda. I think David did a great job of outlining all the benefits. From a carbon reduction standard, Oregon needs to be doing more to make sure that we're investing in clean energy, repowering with clean energy. As a member-based organization, I can say people are excited about clean energy here in Oregon. There's this expectation that we are a green leader, but less than 0.1% of our energy is currently coming from the sun in Oregon. You hear about all of the other development of solar happening in states like Utah. It should be happening here, whether it's from an environmental perspective or from an economic perspective. This is good for Oregon, and I think the bill really reflects the hard work of David Brown and other folks to take feedback, learn from last session, and actually come up with a bill that does a lot for clean energy, allows the state to get in the game, and really repower. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon Building Trades Council, which is an umbrella organization for about 25,000 union construction workers. And we wish to go on record in support of House Bill 4037, the bill and the amendments as described by Mr. Brown. If I may go back to Representative Boone's question about the workforce. Mr. Brown stated that he has had IBW members install the solar panels, and I just want to go on record that we already have a well-trained IBW members and other construction craft members throughout the state that are already trained and in place and ready to go to work on the construction of the projects. And so the journeymen and women and apprentices of this council support this measure. We believe it'll incent economic development and job opportunities for our members, especially in rural areas of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thanks.
Next up, we have Rhett Lawrence, Brian Krieg, and Jamie Valdez.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
I'm just wondering how long we're going to let the senator stay with us over there.
I know. Until he moves on to the other chamber, I suppose.
Rather senatorial.
Is that an upgrade or a downgrade?
We heard it here first.
He's looking out there.
He doesn't slouch anymore after that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thank you for the opportunity to testify for you today. I'm going to also keep it brief, and I've submitted some written testimony to you, too. I will not read that. But as an organization with a long history of working to support renewable energy in Oregon, we do believe that House Bill 4037 can go a long way toward continued expansion of solar power in our state. And do so at a reasonable cost. We are appreciative of the jobs and property tax dollars that this bill could bring to the state. But what's really important for the Sierra Club is the amount of carbon emissions that we believe that can come from this program. You heard David Brown estimate about 5 million tons of CO2 over the next 30 years at about a dollar per ton. So it seems like a pretty reasonable cost for that, and making a real difference in our state's environment. So in closing, we think it's time to get serious about fighting climate change in Oregon and weaning ourselves from fossil fuel. We believe this bill takes us a long way down that road, and so we strongly support it and urge you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg representing the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. That is all seven of the IBEW locals in the state of Oregon, about 9,000 members. We're here today to support the bill and the amendment. This measure has been tightened and focused since the last time. I think a great job has been done on that. It's going to speed growth in rural Oregon, add to the tax base, provide great jobs. And I think really, really important here has been noted is that we're going to be looking at meeting Oregon's energy goals here in Oregon with our own people working on it. The IBEW members are skilled in construction of these types of projects, and we look forward to getting to work on them. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair Peterson, members of the committee, my name is James Valdez, and I represent Northwest Sustainable Energy for Economic Development. I'll also try to keep my comments brief. We support this bill and the amendments. We feel that it does bring some really valuable and needed jobs to our state and really ensures that some things happen in the short term and in the near term to move us towards a cleaner energy future. And so for all those reasons that have been articulated before, we support this bill.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you all very much for coming today. And next we have Andrea Durbin.
Good morning, Chair Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Durbin. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Environmental Council, and I won't take up much time this morning, but we did want to go on record this morning supporting House Bill 4037 as well, not only because it delivers real jobs and economic opportunities for parts of the state, rural economic opportunities for around the state, but we also see it as an important a solution for reducing carbon and making significant reductions in carbon, and we support the work and the amendments that David Brown has done. So thank you very much for the opportunity to express that support today.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Durbin? Okay, thank you very much. So we have both the bill and the amendment are up and available on OLIS committee. So you can take a look at that. And we already have this bill posted for Thursday, so please take time to go over it.
Good job.
And... okay. Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. I didn't see you run your note. Come on up. Can you briefly give your testimony? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Solar Energy Industries Association, here to support House Bill 4036. There's probably about 17 or 18 jobs in the pipeline that this this bill would help unlock, and that would be a good thing for the industry. It could be a good thing for Oregon. Good bill should pass. Happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative
Rudin. You really meant 4037, right?
4037, yes. Sorry.
Just
checking.
And Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff, I think you might be one of the best people to answer this question.
Oh, Lord.
I think from experience, we understand that getting the enthusiasm to build these projects is one thing. Getting the energy onto the grid is another thing. And it's particularly interesting to me that the department here is the lead agency, but on the back end we have to do all this work through PURPA, through the PURPA process. Is there anything else this bill should have as a statement of legislative intent that would make the PURPA process easier?
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, on this bill, probably not. I think focusing on the financing of the projects and the incentives to make it go, I think is good to keep it focused. That's a fair question on the next bill that you're about to hear that I mistakenly talked about. So on 4037, I think it's good to go. 4036 also good to go, but there are some policy questions that should be raised. And again, if not in that bill, then perhaps in a 2017 bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. right? Everything I said before still applies. Well, so be prepared for Thursday. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4037, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 4036, the RPS agreement bill. And Beth, can you give us a summary of that bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4036 is a bill that I believe the first person who's going to be speaking is going to run through the bill, so I'm not going to spend time doing that. But there is, just for your information, a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. All right, the first panel I'm going to call up will be Varner Seaman, Rachel Shimshak, and Amy Hudzianowski.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm here today representing Portland General Electric and speaking in favor of House Bill 4036. I'm going to quickly walk through the elements of the bill, and I also want to point out there's a document that should be on OLIS, which is a written comparison prepared by Portland General Electric and Pacific Power that was submitted for the record at the PUC hearing last Friday on this bill. I'm going to walk through largely these documents, but I want to make sure that folks are aware that that's there for reference. We also have, for the record, in the deck on the left that I'll reference briefly at the end is also what we submitted for the record at the Public Utilities Commission for hearing on Friday of last week, talking about the cost and the carbon implications of this piece of legislation. So what I'm going to walk through are 7 points about what this bill does. The first point is that this is a bill that is largely about two investor-owned utilities here in Oregon, Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp, except for one element that I'll address at the end of this. This is a bill that only encumbers the two investor-owned utilities and largely leaves the consumer-owned utilities in the state with the status quo in terms of policy for renewable energy in the state. And for those utilities, as this committee heard during the interim committee days, this is a bill that puts PG and Pacific Power on track to be meeting our GHG reduction targets through the life of this bill, headed towards the GHG reduction and goals that are in statute that the Global Warming Commission oversees our process on, or our progress on. Second thing this bill does is it sets a date certain for the end of use of coal by Oregon customers. For the customers of Pacific Power and PGE, it sets a date of 2030 at which we will no longer be using coal here in Oregon. There is one note that for PGE that has a minority ownership share in the Colstrip facility, we have the ability to petition the Public Utilities Commission for up to a 5-year extension if there's not a closure agreement in place or that's acted upon prior to 2035. I think that this is a pretty important piece of the bill. The end of coal is something that we hear pretty clearly that customers of Oregon utilities are looking for. This is something that we see when we do our resource planning and we survey customers and we survey Oregonians, that overwhelmingly Oregonians do not want utilities to continue to generate electricity from coal. This is true in both urban areas, rural areas, and it's a bipartisan issue in Oregon that folks no longer want us to be using coal. And this bill addresses that issue. I think one of the things that's important to note is that the bill, HB 4036, differs somewhat from the proposed ballot measures that this bill was negotiated to respond to, in that there is increased flexibility for Pacific Power to use coal post the depreciation date of those facilities. And as I noted, we have some increased flexibility with the Colstrip facility. I believe, and Pacific Power will testify in a little bit, I think that for that utility, this is a pretty significant cost saving of this piece of legislation over the proposed ballot measures, but they can speak to that in a little bit. third thing that the bill does is it has stair steps in the bill for extending the renewable portfolio standard, increasing starting in 2025, moving the RPS target from 25% new renewables as part of the resource mix to 27%, and then stair stepping up from there. A big part of the negotiations on 4036 was for PGE's part to match what we anticipate our resource needs will be for generation with the stair steps in this bill. What we see is that, as this committee has heard in the past, we're no longer going to be using coal to generate electricity at the Boardman facility at the end of 2020. We are losing some contracts for hydropower, which is, of course, a zero-carbon resource, and we're going to need to replace those. And we anticipate that the coal strip facility that we have an ownership share in, it is reasonable to expect that we're no longer going to be able to take power from that facility, not just because of this legislation, but because of other pressures, regional haze, the Federal Clean Power Plan, the need to put on additional pollution controls, that we would need to replace that power as well. So as we look at this bill, and I think one of the questions we're going to hear is, what does this bill do? What is the main impact? What does this practically mean? Largely what this bill means is that as we look at replacing those resources and dealing with the growing load or the growing demand for electricity in our system, we're going to be largely replacing those resources with high renewable energy scenarios and a little bit of natural gas for integration purposes, as opposed to high natural gas replacement scenarios and a little bit of renewables. I think one of the things that people need to understand at the outset on this bill is that we will have, as a utility, the need to build more resources to meet our generation. It's a question of what those resources will be, and as we look at this bill, it directs that to be more of a renewable resource development as opposed to natural gas resource replacement. Fourth thing that the bill does is it changes some of the accounting rules for the investor-owned utilities and how we use renewable energy credits and how we're able to bank and do the accounting for the use of those renewable energy credits. As this committee is aware, renewable energy credits under rule in Oregon are what we call the currency of compliance. That is the track record of the generation of renewable energy. That's what we retire to demonstrate compliance. We agreed to some changes in the accounting rules to incentivize early action and to give us some flexibility over the life of the bill in terms of the timing of resource acquisition. We think that what we have is some of the accounting rules in terms of the RECs are a positive change. We think we can manage through this, and we think that it gives us some tools to manage the cost of this policy. I think it's also worth noting that for the consumer-owned utilities in the state of Oregon, the REC accounting rules stay the same. As we've talked to our friends who represent the consumer-owned utilities in the state, changing the accounting rules for RECs, as would have been happening in the ballot measure, would have impacted their operations and their plans for RPS compliance significantly. We think that it is reasonable, as we're looking at this bill, for the changes only to be for the investor-owned utilities and not the consumer-owned utilities. And a big part of it is the consumer-owned utilities in the state don't have carbon emissions to speak of. They largely get their resources from the Bonneville system, which is largely hydro. Largely is probably a big understatement on that, those hydro resources don't have emissions associated with them. This is, for us, this is our carbon reduction plan to get us in compliance with the glide path that we need to be on to meet the GHG reduction targets for the state. It's appropriate for us to change the rules for the investor-owned utilities. We think that it's appropriate also for the COUs to stay with the same path that they have for RECs. That's PG's opinion on that. It's also worth noting that different from the ballot measures, there is no definition of renewable energy credit in statute. I think that was one of the things that was discussed quite a bit as we negotiated the legislation. It's important for us to keep flexibility as we, for PGE, as we deal with the rule development under the Clean Power Plan. It's in the spreadsheet or the matrix that you've got on OLIS. I just want to make reference to that. Fifth thing that this bill does is that there are some new protections in the bill, and we keep one of the existing consumer protections. So the 4% cost cap that has been in place, that overall the cost of meeting the renewable portfolio standard cannot raise rates for utility customers by more than 4%, that stays in place. We have, up to this point, largely been able to meet the renewable portfolio portfolio standard, the existing standard, without getting past that cost cap. We anticipate we'll be able to do that with some of the smoothing that we have in this bill, but that protection stays in place. We have added a reliability tool in the bill. I think one way we would refer to this is it's not an off-ramp, it's a pit stop. If on the acquisition of renewables, we anticipate that we may run into a challenge with being able to maintain very high reliability, which is important for industry in the state, is important for our residential customers in the state, we can go to the Public Utilities Commission and work with them on getting a plan in place to be able to continue or get back on track meeting the standard and maintaining the level of reliability that folks expect from us. There is also in the bill a rate smoothing mechanism so that we can time the acquisition of resources and when those fall into rates. We think this is further a beneficial impact or a beneficial provision for consumers and a protection that's in the bill. The sixth thing that the bill does is it adds a provision which around community solar. As this committee is aware, you acted in the 2015 legislative session and the long session to direct the Public Utilities Commission to do some study on how to design a community solar program, make recommendations back to the body in terms of that program could be structured. The Public Utilities Commission did that work. We think they did a pretty solid job of making sure that the costs of a community solar are borne by the participants of a community solar program. They've got some good rate setting in there, and the rules that they put forward are a good recommendation. We see including community solar in this bill, including a low-income carve-out, as completing the work that this committee began in 2015, and I think that it's something that we're happy to see included in this bill. I'm sure we'll have some conversation about it as we go forward. The seventh thing that the bill does, and this is important for stability in the state as we go forward, is that it has some provisions about a level playing field. For the investor-owned utilities, we're changing the paradigm, moving to a 50% renewable standard. For our utility, that's going to mean by 2040, at least 60% of our generation mix will be non-carbon emitting. We wanted to make sure that if customers choose to leave our system, that the renewables requirements of the state of Oregon follow with them. And so there are provisions that if you do a hostile takeover of investor-owned utility service territory, that those renewables requirements will follow with the customer. So that's the high-level summary of what the bill does. We think that we've got a good product here, and we support the bill. Two things just to add, and this is in the PowerPoint that I won't take the time to walk through, but it's available on OLIS if people want to look at it, that we submitted to the commission. The cost for PGE as we model this bill, and we believe that we have engaged in, and as the Oregonian has reported, and they described it this way, that we use some fairly conservative assumptions. And the way that I would describe it is, if this is the glide path, actually from your perspective, that rates will be on in the future, we know that there's going to be some inflation that occurs, healthcare costs, just inflation that occurs in the economy. Overall, this curve will go up about 1.5%. There will be cost increases associated with this, but we think that those are manageable and those are reasonable given how much Oregonians want us to decrease emissions on our system, and we think that this is an appropriate cost. Finally, we did modeling that was, we think, very thorough modeling on the carbon implications of this bill. And I think that you all have seen before the slide from the Global Warming Commission that shows the downward trajectory of emissions for both PG and PacifiCorp. I'll just reference in this PowerPoint that we do have a curve that shows PGE for our system under this bill, our system emissions getting below the line that would have us on track to meet the GHG reduction requirements for the state. We also modeled, and I think that one of the questions is, because this bill does not require coal plants to close There's no legislation in Oregon that can force a plant in another state to close per the U.S. Constitution. But we have modeled using our full modeling Aurora software, and we show that over the life of this bill, we will have 30 million metric tons of carbon reductions throughout the western United States, and then 2040 will be a point of 4 million metric tons annually of carbon reductions associated with this bill. So with that, I'll finish and hand over. Thank you.
Do you want to ask any questions? Or
we'll wait till everybody's had a chance.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Shimshak, and I'm the Executive Director of Renewable Northwest. We're a regional advocacy organization of businesses and nonprofits, and we support the implementation of responsible renewables throughout the Northwest. I'm here today to voice our strong support for HB 4036 that will support the economy and the environment. HB 4036 marks a historic moment for Oregon. It captures the will of the people to clean up our energy supply and puts us firmly on a path to grow our generous endowment of renewable energy resources to meet our needs. It sends the message that our citizens are ready to transition away from coal resources to a future that keeps the air clean and supports our treasured quality of life. It continues our tradition of leadership on clean energy. The current renewable energy standard has given us 8 years of experience in increasing the amount of clean energy in our portfolio. It's a proven policy that has delivered real benefits at modest cost. This bill continues the sustained, orderly development of renewables that has helped our state benefit economically. Projects that have located in rural parts of the state have generated $150 million in local benefits and paid local landowners royalties for those farmers and ranchers sponsoring wind, solar, and geothermal projects on their land. And that helps sustain those areas and families, especially during the Great Recession. The counties have been able to invest in education programs, public safety, roads, and even given money back to year-round residents. That's taking place in Sherman County. The positive business climate that the RPS has helped to attract, attract energy manufacturers, developers, marketers, environmental and permitting consultants to the urban side of the state as well. It isn't often that you get one single policy that supports both the rural and the urban parts of the state. And the ramp up to 50% of the RPS standard in the bill will continue to attract and keep businesses here. The dramatic drop in prices for wind and solar over the past 5 years, 60 and 80% respectively, bodes well for the affordability of the proposal. We commissioned our own financial analysis that showed that implementing HB 4036 is low cost. The bill provides utilities incentives for early action on renewables, and happily, the federal government serendipitously has helped us underscore this element by extending the federal tax credits for solar and wind and other renewables, helping us move forward at even lower cost to customers. An increased renewable standard helps reduce carbon because utilities will always choose the resource with no fuel costs as they dispatch the system. So each time a wind or a solar resource generates a kilowatt hour, it displaces fossil fuels in the supply and reduces emissions. The more renewables, the less fossil fuel burned. And because there are no fuel costs, renewables are sort of like a 30-year mortgage. You know the cost of that resource at the very first day, and it stays the same over the lifetime. No fuel price volatility. I wanted to underscore something that Varner mentioned, and that is that the intention of the renewable standard is to influence the resources that utilities use to meet their customer needs. And these decisions last 30 or 40 years. So without this bill, we might just be replacing one fossil fuel like coal with another fossil fuel like gas. HB 4036 ensures that renewables will make up a substantial portion of the replacement power as coal units retire. We consider that a no regrets policy, and that makes a big difference for emissions also. 4036 provides certainty for utilities and for the market for new renewables. When both utilities know that they have to get coal out of the supply and increase renewables, they can turn their attention to getting the job done in the most cost-efficient way instead of worrying that that there's a competition between them. Other features of the bill underscore the importance of cost-effective energy efficiency and demand response, both of which will help us balance the system, and also calls for a community solar program to provide access to solar resources for those who may not have a suitable roof, including those in the low-income community. And before I close, I just want to say how remarkable it is that the disparate parties who regularly spar with each other in the regulatory process were able to find common cause on this bill. The parties worked hard and honestly with each other, and I believe we arrived at a proposal that paves an Oregon path to a clean energy future, one that reflects our history, our experience, our people, and our values. Thank you.
And I'll just remind everyone, because we have several panels who are going to testify, so if you have submitted recent written testimony, you don't need to read the whole thing. You can just summarize that. But we'll definitely, everything's available or will be available on OLIS. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Hutchnowski, and I'm the senior campaign representative with the Beyond Coal campaign of the Sierra Club. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today on behalf of House Bill 4036. The Sierra Club is our nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization, and our goals of protecting our environment and our health are also core values shared by Oregonians throughout our state, and I'm proud today to represent the 22,000 members and activists across Oregon. We are also proud of our legacy as a national leader addressing the threat of climate change and expanding clean energy resources like wind and solar, but much more can and must be done, and Oregonians have time and again demanded action of their elected leaders and officials to combat climate change. It's time to move our state away from dirty, polluting energy of the past and toward more sustainable clean energy resources. That is the challenge before us today. Coal-fired plants, power plants are our nation's single largest source of carbon pollution, and yet while, as Varner said, our state's lone coal-fired plant is on track to retire, our electric utilities continue to burn out-of-state coal from way too much of our electricity. 34% of our electricity that powers our homes and businesses here in Oregon is generated by these outdated coal-fired power plants. And in fact, most of those plants are in need of significant and expensive pollution control upgrades to meet modern clean air standards, posing a significant financial liability to ratepayers here at home. Public polling just released this morning shows that 7 out of 10 Oregonians across party lines want the legislature to act and pass this measure. There is overwhelming support across the state to stop paying for and supporting the 20-plus aging and polluting coal burners of the West that supply our power and instead invest in clean energy jobs at home and in our region. House Bill 4036 finally unties our hands from coal while also raising the bar for our renewable standards so that we do not replace one fossil fuel with another. Now, through the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Plan, we have the opportunity to make real on that vision and to advance the clean energy solutions that Oregonians have been asking for. Let's not miss this opportunity to make real and substantial strides in addressing the threat of climate change while also opening the market for more clean, renewable energy. Thank you for your time and consideration of my testimony in support of House Bill 4036.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Whitener.
I'm sure. Actually, I have two questions. Is that okay?
Yes.
So, first one, Varner, I just want to make sure I have this clear in your testimony. Ratepayers can expect to see a 4% increase each year, roughly, for the next 20 years?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener, thank you for the question. Spent a fair amount of time last night going through this with our director of rates and regulatory work, and the way that we would characterize it is that we anticipate that on average in a given year rates will be about a 1.5% higher under this. That sort of the over the period of the bill that the cost to customers will be about 1.5%.
So if it was normally 3%, it's going to be 4.5% that they would see their increase each year.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener, in a given year, if we had a 3% for other reasons, yes, it'd be about a percent and a half higher than that, whatever that rolled up with that 3%. I think that when we look back over the last several years, we've been running at about a 2% kind of an increase. But the way that rates work, we go through a pretty robust stakeholder process at the Public Utilities Commission where people can contest what's prudent, what's not prudent. We don't necessarily see a rate increase every year. Actually, our rates just went down January 1 of this year for a period of months. So you do get some variation. But we're looking at, on average, and our modeling shows that rate impacts would be different year to year under this bill. But on average, that glide path increasing about 1.5%.
And then second question. I mean, looking at this, and maybe it's something for the Sierra Club, possibly. I'm not a fan of wind, I'm going to be honest with you, and solar, because you drive out across these landscapes that used to be beautiful, and now there's these big wind turbines sitting all over the place, and they're a big eyesore to me. I do a lot of hunting, fishing. What is the plan? Because even wind doesn't blow all the time. The sun, obviously, we're in Oregon, does not shine all the time. What's our plan for baseload power? I mean, is there anything like that you've thought of? And nuclear would be one of the options I've brought before this committee and things like that, but we need baseload power because wind and solar do not give us baseload power for running our plants and factories or even our homes.
Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Widener, it's a good question, and it's a very popular question. It's true that wind and solar and hydro, for that matter, are variable resources, and they are seasonal, and they work when the sun shines and the wind blows. The truth is that the operators of the system are very sharp and figure out how all of those resources can work together. You can predict when the wind is going to blow and when the sun is going to shine, and the operators figure out the geographic diversity of the different resources that they have, and together with energy efficiency and demand response and storage and flexible gas, we think that there is a way to continue to deliver reliable power at low cost to customers so that you have the same features as the system does today.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener. Fast-acting gas becomes pretty important to figure in there, and having the capacity to ramp up gas. I mean, we still are going to need to have some fossil component. I think a reference that, you know, 60% will be non-emitting at 2040 of our mix. The other 40 will largely be natural gas to provide that resource. There's also some of the work that we're doing with the energy imbalance market. Pacific Core is a little bit further ahead of us, working on west-wide coordination to be able to get resources as part of that. And I think at some point this committee may look further into those issues. But we are highly confident that under this plan, we can maintain reliability. We can hit that 50%. And I would note that we're going to be about 10 years behind California moving to a 50% standard. So we're going to have about a decade to have some lessons learned out of that before we're at that level.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're here today hearing this bill because of the threat of ballot measures. Can you explain to the committee why this pathway, the legislative pathway, is a better pathway for Oregon ratepayers and energy consumers than the proposed ballot measures would be?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson, I think there are a couple of different reasons why we prefer this approach to the ballot measure. The first is that we believe that there are additional flexibility that was negotiated into this bill in the PowerPoint that's up on OLIS and up on the screen here. There's some, or not up on the screen there, on this little screen here. Yeah, you've got it there. We do some scenarios running base case, high renewables, a high gas scenario, and I think we show that the flexibility under this bill relative to the ballot measure is pretty significant cost savings, I think in the $200-300 million range over the life of it. So that's the first part. The second part is that we were able to add some things such as the reliability provision, some of the rec banking provisions we think are important additions to the bill. And then I think overall, one of the things that's important to us is that as the legislature takes up issues, we've seen historically that the legislature is willing to go back and improve upon their work product and modify things. When ballot measures pass, we think it can be very difficult to go in and kind of get under the hood and tinker with those. So we very much prefer a legislative approach to a ballot measure approach because we think it gives us the flexibility we need to go back and improve upon things as we go forward. So from our perspective, having you act as opposed to having something on the ballot is much more preferable. Not to mention that getting into a ballot measure fight, as we all know, it's going to be a crowded ballot in 2016, and we would rather not have another very expensive, contentious fight. You know, and something where largely on the question of whether or not we're going to burn coal, we think that the writing's on the wall. I mean, our CEO said in spring or fall of 2015 at a conference in Portland that the writing's on the wall and that the future for coal is limited. So we would rather have legislation that gives us some certainty in that transition rather than having some other policy come in that would be more costly, chaotic, and where we'd still have to do these types of actions.
In your testimony or in your presentation, you mentioned the Western Energy Imbalance Market. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk a bit about what role that might play in trying to, I think it might get back to her answer over here.
Yeah, quickly. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. The Energy Imbalance Market is maybe one of the wonkiest energy issues going on these days, but it's probably one of the most important. What we're looking at is better coordination between the dozens of balancing areas through the West. Eastern U.S., east of the Rockies, has about 6-7 balancing areas that manage the grid for the entirety of the East. We've got a highly balkanized system in the West. Essentially, what the EIM is an electronic trading platform similar to kayak.com to buy plane tickets. So replacing a system where you pick up the phone to buy and sell power between balancing areas, you've got pathways for transmission and a computer trading system so that we've got the much better ability to move power large distances throughout the West. I mean, as folks on this committee are aware, but I think largely we're going to understand, is that we have a long history of sending power hundreds and thousands of miles in the West, and an EIM really helps us do that more efficiently, so we're getting more bang for the buck and lowering the cost and making the whole system West-wide more efficient.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Varner, my first question is for you. Correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't PG&E have a guaranteed margin in your contract?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, we're rate regulated and we are able to return on equity investments. And we have, through the regulated process, we don't have a guaranteed rate of return, but the Public Utilities Commission sets the return on equity rate, and then we are able to try to earn up to that rate and not exceed it. So we have, I believe, a return on investment rate, and I can go back and make sure I've got this precise, but last time I checked, it's roughly a little above 7% and the ability to earn up to about 9.6% on our investments.
Paula?
So, you know, my concerns have been, as I'm listening to this, is part of the argument has been is that supposedly there's two sides to this argument, two groups essentially, but I don't quite see it that way. And I don't think most of the citizens who have to pay the power bills because of the consequences of our legislation that we might be putting through here are part of the table. I'm certainly not, as a ratepayer, feeling like I'm being represented in this argument. If you have a guaranteed margin, to me, just in basic math, that means that if you're selling something at 10 cents a kilowatt right now and you have, say, 10%, it's a penny of take-home net profit. If it's at 20 cents a kilowatt, now it's going to be 2 cents. And then furthermore, isn't coal right now somewhere in that, your purchase price somewhere in that 2 cents a kilowatt? You probably buy it in megawatts, I'm assuming, but I've heard 2 cents a kilowatt was a number that stuck in my mind.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, a couple things to draw a distinction on. We don't earn on our overall rate base. Most things, and a lot of the things, get more precise than that. We don't return on our overall rate structure. Many of the things in our company are what we call pass-through costs. So if we pay taxes, we pass that through. If we have an expense of purchased power on the market, we pass that through. Where we make capital investments and we are the owners on a capital investment and we put our money to work over a period of time, we're able to earn on that capital investment. Now, there's no difference to us from an earnings perspective for shareholders between investing in a gas plant, investing in a coal plant, investing in a renewable facility, because we're making that capital investment and earning on that capital. So really, I mean, the markets are somewhat agnostic between different types of investment. And as I was saying a moment ago, we're going to have to build new resources to meet load to replace resources that are going away regardless. Really, this bill is about, are we making those investments in renewables or are we making those investments in a fossil plant? So I think in terms of looking at, does growth of cost in our system increase our earnings? That is not the case. Where we're able to compete through a regulated process of the PUC to own an asset, that does have an impact in terms of our earnings. But it's really agnostic. Capital is agnostic between types of generation mix.
And it's a question. It's sure. Can I assume, though, that almost because of the way this all operates between you and the PUC and whatnot, there's almost no way you can lose money? You're guaranteed certain returns that...
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Hurd, I'm sure our shareholder folks are cringing that I'm going to try to answer this question. I wouldn't say that that's a guarantee. I mean, there are some examples of utilities that have gone bankrupt. I mean, in Montana, there was Montana Power experience a bankruptcy in the last 20 years. I mean, it is possible for utilities to lose money. If we make investments that are not deemed prudent by the Public Utilities Commission, we cannot recover those investments. So we work very closely with the commission to make sure that we're making decisions that are meeting their least cost, least risk thresholds, that we're going through those processes, and that we are being prudent in that process. So, thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. And just following up with that, you had mentioned earlier about some changes to the accounting rules and to the definition of RECs and just being prudent and everything. In regards to that, are these changes consistent with current PUC rules around these accounting methods and the definition of RECs?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, around the definition of RECs, I mean, currently the REC accounting rules are part of statute in Senate Bill 838 that was passed in 2007. What we're doing in this bill is, in 2007, renewable energy credits could be banked, and so in existing law, renewable energy credits could be, once they were generated, you could keep them in a bank and use them indefinitely. So you could hold, in theory, you could hold a REC for 100 years. As well, there was a provision, first in, first out accounting, that the first REC you generated, you had to retire first. What we replace that with in this bill is a little bit more complex structure that for that existing bank that we have, we're no longer going to have the first in, first out requirement. For new build resources after the passage of this date, if the legislature were to pass HB 4036, which we would hope that the legislature would, that in the next period of time, that for new build projects for 5 years, they would generate unlimited RECs, which incentivizes early action because those we think would have a high value. And then after that, the life of a REC goes to 5 years. And so for, and also for resources existing today, after passage of this act, new RECs generated would be a five-year life. So that's a change from what is in statute that I believe is reflected in PUC rule, but I'd have to defer in terms of what exactly the the status as the PUC rules, but it is a change in statute that directs the PUC.
Follow up. So with that, I assume the PUC is engaged in this process of changing these and is in agreement with how this will end up working. I'm just worried about how the regulation and accounting system impacts the RECs long term.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holby, I think Jason Eisdorfer is likely to testify in a little bit. I'd defer questions in terms of, you know, the PUC's opinion in terms of the workability of it. I don't think that we've seen the REC accounting provision as something which is going to be a problem, and we haven't heard that as a concern.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yep. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for all your work on this, Varner, and meeting with us during the previous days. The question I have has to do with the questions I ask Mr. Brown earlier, and that is, how much money do you see this program driving toward renewables? And I don't need a specific number. Give me a guess. Over the next, and this is a long time, we're talking, 30 years here?
Over.
So a lot of money. So how much?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, I don't have a specific dollar figure, but I would answer the question this way. Currently, we're at about 15% renewables. Today, we're meeting our 15% renewables. We're going to need to move up by about 45% to hit 50% over the next 25 years. Generally, rule of thumb, renewables, you need to build about the nameplate capacity needs to be about triple the target. So for our system that has an average load of roughly 2,000 megawatts, we'd need to add, 45% of that, we would need to add, multiply that times 3. That will get you your nameplate capacity, roughly speaking. And then I'd defer to David Brown or somebody with a little bit more precise on what that capital investment would require. And again, I would say that's going to be a pretty significant. I would imagine between PG and PacifiCorp, it's going to be in the range of billions of dollars and the low billions of dollars in the next few years. What I would restate is that we are going to be in a period of capital acquisition regardless. It's a question of what that capital acquisition is. We're going to have to spend one way or the other. It's a question, are we spending on renewables or are we spending on natural gas? And actually, just one correction, I misstated. I said 45%. 50 minus 15 is 35%, not 45%. Clearly, I'm not doing the rate making. And Rachel, do you want to answer that?
I love it when he does that. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, I don't think there's any way to know precisely how much money will be invested, but I suppose what we could say is over the last decade, about 3,000 megawatts have been built in the state of Oregon, and it's our view that this particular policy will probably incent 3,000 megawatts worth of new renewables, and that number of renewables resulted in $9 billion worth of investment and 5,000 jobs and the $150 million worth of local revenue that I referenced before, plus payments to landowners, farmers, and ranchers who have sponsored projects on their land. So it will probably not be the case that every one of these resources will be located in Oregon, but we hope that a substantial amount of them will, and that's just a reference point for you.
Follow up. Thank you. Well, of course, we want to go beyond hope, don't we? We want for sure that money is spent here in Oregon, since Oregon ratepayers are paying it. So that would be a pretty important piece. But what I'm really getting at here is, I don't want to understate the value of what I just said, but what I'm really interested in is the cost per ton of CO2 reduced by virtue of this program. So I'm sure you have that number readily available.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, I don't have that number readily available, but I can work with our folks and I can work to get you a cost per ton CO2 number. I don't have that off the top of my head, and I know you'd asked for that in the past. I'm sorry I didn't get that for you.
Follow up. Okay, so I've asked for it in the past, and of course the reason I've asked for it in the past is because we Republicans are extraordinarily interested in making sure these programs actually achieve the purpose for which we're going to be paying, mm-hmm. and that would be CO2 reduction. and how in the world we could make a decent decision about whether or not this program makes sense without knowing how much per ton is costing us to engage in it is really a question. A really important question. So I don't know why that isn't just like right at the top of the list of things that you would tell us. So we in turn could say, gee, because I think Mr. Brown touched upon in his remarks what his cost would be, but I have no clue what it is in these billions of dollars and how much we're actually going to get. I note in the materials right here that it suggests we won't see any CO2 reduction for 10 years. And those of us that are concerned about this problem, and we are, would say, why aren't the environmental interests saying, calling this out instead of cheering for this as though it were the thing that's going to save all of our lives? I'm serious about this because we're spending billions to try to address this issue, and yet I haven't heard one word about how you have prioritized for us this investment. Not a word.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, I appreciate this question, and I think that we're approaching it perhaps in a from a different perspective on it. What we believe is that we will be required to the goals that are in statute right now, and remember the GHG reduction goals are not mandatory, they're not obligations, those are targets and those are goals in statute today. We believe that since those goals were passed and that glide path was created of 75% reductions over 1990 levels as a state, that those essentially become the benchmark for which policymakers will hold us as we go forward. And what we very much believe is that customers want to see our emissions on our system reach that target so that we are in a glide path to be in compliance with those goals. The question then that we look at is what actions will we need to take to be able to be on track to be tracking with those emissions reductions goals and to be matching that downward curve. The question for us is what actions does it take for us to be on track to meet those that glide path and those emissions reduction goals? The actions that are available to us today with available technology are investments in energy efficiency, which we've been making since 1999, moving forward, starting to increasingly deploy demand response. We know that it is stopping to use coal, and it is largely replacing that with renewables and not relying entirely on natural gas. Later today, there's going to be a hearing on a cap-and-trade proposal that talks about putting a price on carbon, similar to how the Clean Power Plan has already, we believe, put a price on carbon. We think that the price and sort of those other program areas, at the end of the day, those talk about raising revenue, those talk about spending in other areas of the economy and doing offsets and other things to reduce emissions. We think ultimately what we are going to be held to is what are the emissions on our system and how do we get to a place where we are hitting the GHG reduction goals that are in statute for our system. And in our minds, this is the only way to do it is what we talked about, energy efficiency, stop using coal, and a high renewables replacement scenario. That's different from saying this is the price per ton, generally speaking, throughout the economy. We understand you have a bill in terms of carbon metrics to look at that scoring of it, but there's a question of what is the cheapest, generally speaking, economy-wide versus what is the cost to reduce the emissions on our system, and this is an approach that gets to emissions reductions on our system.
Yes, but we have got a running short on time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to ask one question. In your bill, under energy efficiency on page, I'm not sure what page it's on, I don't know if it's a new phrase, and that's why I'm going to ask, but it says under energy efficiency that the companies will, quote, plan for and pursue. That's an interesting statement, and I tried to find out what your current standard was. Is it a higher level of required energy efficiency currently, and does this reduce that level, or is this about the same? Where does that fit in the current energy efficiency universe?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz. We currently, and since 1999, with the passage of Senate Bill 1149 and the creation of the public purpose charge, plan for and work to achieve all cost-effective energy efficiency. And the important phrase is cost-effective energy efficiency. And that is what we've been doing through the Energy Trust of Oregon since the early 2000s. We don't see, we think that this is simply reflecting what the standard is currently and restating it. We don't think that this is going to be a change in the acquisition of all cost-effective energy efficiency as we do so now. So status quo, no change.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Next, we actually have Senator Beyer, who is here, who wanted to speak on an amendment that he has on the bill. Welcome. We actually have a senator now.
A real one.
Yeah. And welcome, Senator Beyer. And just for everybody here, as you can tell, we're only going till 10 o'clock today. I'm going to give preference to the folks who I know wouldn't be able to be here on Thursday, who have traveled more than 100 miles from the meeting. So that's going to impact how the rest of the panels are called up. All right. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Lee Beyer. I represent Senate District 6, which is the central portions of Lane and Linn counties. Wanted to come today to specifically address the Dash 15 amendments to the bill, which deal with the community solar portion. And I guess for those who haven't been familiar with it, and you probably are since you guys were here last time, we sent the having discussed this the last couple of sessions and how to go about doing this, we asked the PUC to come up and give us recommendations on what we should do if we chose to do a policy. So this is largely informed by the result. I've been working with Representative Hovey on this bill. Essentially, what this does is it makes it possible for those people who don't have the south-facing roof to do it on their own, or maybe they're in a rental facility, to participate in a larger solar project. And the advantages of that principally are with the larger projects, you can get it professionally managed, and it's cheaper because you don't have to buy all the individual systems for each one. So that's essentially what the bill does. And it's fairly broad, and you should think about these like a condominium. That's the concept that works for me best, is saying so you're, as a owner, you're owning a part of the project that's just yours, like an apartment in a large building, and in common, you're owning the whole system. This is intentionally structured to be very broad because we don't know exactly what developers will do in terms of putting a community solar project together. Over a number of years, I've looked at them in other states, and one of the things that becomes very clear to me is if this is a policy that we're going to allow, is we probably need to start out pretty broad and then see how that works. And mostly it grants the Public Utility Commission the right to do this. Should be very clear that this only applies to the investor-owned utilities, and the reason is that the consumer-owned utilities can do this already under their own direction with their locally elected boards. In fact, a number of them in the state are currently doing this. But at this point, the investor-owned utilities are prohibited from doing that. So this is an enabling legislation. Gets there. The one piece that perhaps the chair and I disagree upon is whether this should have a specific set-aside or subsidy for low-income members who participate. I personally, from my experience from 10 years on the PUC, believe that's not a good idea. And the reason being, not that I don't think everybody should have a chance, but solar tends to be a bit more expensive than market. Mainly when we're talking about the low-income community, what we're talking about is bill assistance to lower their costs so they don't have to trade off, am I going to keep it warm or am I going to buy food for my family? This is, I think that's a key issue. Although I respect that others may have a different opinion on that, and you'll hear that. So, again, this is fairly open. I'm not going to go into the details of it unless you have questions. I did want to comment on the general bill that's in front of you today. We'll get another shot of that on the other side of the building. But as I've listened to the testimony today, it reminded me a lot of the discussion on the original RPS and discussions we had on, you know, on coal and that sort of thing in my 10 years with the PUC. And I remember during those initial discussions, people were very concerned that the RPS would load on a number of additional costs and throw rates through the roof based on the technology we knew at that time. Reflecting on that, much to my surprise, because I was kind of in that camp, very concerned about it, that has not been the case. In fact, the addition of the utilities and meeting the RPS have not driven rates up. They've largely stayed fairly level. And today, most of the renewable power that's out there is right at market rate or right below market rate. So it's not changed the whole thing. The other thing I would suggest is, and because I've looked at a lot of computer models over my time, is you can project and do a lot of assumptions about what's going to happen in the future. But anybody who can really project out more than 5 years and thinks that they're right, I would really question that. As the old line goes about forecasts, the only thing you really know about a forecast is it's wrong. You just don't know which way and by how much. I would point out that the technology, since really the worldwide, there's been an interest in trying to get carbon less energy generation has happened. Prices for all of the technologies have dramatically fallen. And I suspect we will see that trend continue as people try to address carbon, which I believe is the greenhouse gas effect is probably the most serious issue that's affecting mankind today. And I think it's one that we all, as policy setters, need to pay significant attention to. It is something that's a matter for worrying about our children and our grandchildren, not ourselves. With that, Madam Chair, I would just leave it at that and wish you the best of luck in dealing with this issue. And I'll be looking forward to see what you do with it.
Thank you, Senator. Question, Representative Reardon.
Yeah, thank you for coming over today, Senator. Just real quick, we have a section in here that talks about community solar projects. Could you kind of compare your amendment with that? Or
mine's better.
That's all I needed to hear. All I needed to hear. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
A little more detail, please.
It's been a while since I looked at it, Madam Chair. Yeah. Representative Reardon. I think the amendment the language is in the bill. One, it does address the low income piece, which I'm uncomfortable with. And it's a little more restrictive. I believe that the drafters of the bill were trying to guess where the discussions were going to go, and I think they got pretty close, but I think the amendment that before you has a little more detail. I'd be happy to try and do a comparison, but I can't do it off the top of my head.
I just wanted to know what I was looking for when I'm.
Yeah.
And I think some of the development was happening in parallel as well. So.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Perhaps Representative Holby can answer that question.
I do want to point out, I mean, Senator Byers pointed out the low-income carve-out that's in this bill at 15%. We were really looking at that as a real hard thing to achieve. And, you know, we don't know that, you know, other renewable energy has that kind of a carve-out. So it's specifically for community solar, this carve-out. And it's kind of unclear what that's going to do to the cost of community solar. And I think in proposal that Senator Beyer and I have been working on, we're identifying excess generation to provide a public purpose that will help with low-income issues like bill assistance and perhaps, you know, other public purposes. As you know, I think we need to have the PUC kind of make sure that that's doable. We're really concerned that the 15% may not actually be doable. So that's one of the discussions. We want to make sure that, of course, low-income people derive benefits out of renewables, and, you know, I think we can do that with excess generation, as I recall. So that's one of the key differences, and the rest of it, I think, is designed to follow the PUC recommendations mostly.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
All right, so next I'm going to call up Jason Eisdorfer, Angus Duncan, and Jeff Allen. I think you have a plane to catch. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. It's very good to see you again. Thank you for inviting me to testify. I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. This morning, I'm really serving in two capacities. One is the Chief of Staff of the staff, the small group of staff back at the PUC that's off in a corner somewhere trying to dig into some of the analysis that the utilities provided on Friday to verify that analysis and determine what some of the impacts are. And I'll state right now up front that we really don't have results of that analysis at this point. The second capacity is really representing some of the issues that the commission has seen on the face of the bill. And the commission does not oppose and does not support the bill. The PUC generally doesn't have any argument with a policy to decarbonize the electricity system. And if you pass 4036 and the governor signs it, we will implement it. But the politics of the potential initiative and the politics of the deal that's brought to you seems to us to have overwhelmed some of the underlying policy. And so the commission really wanted me to address some of those issues for your consideration. So it is a mistake to think that the PUC scope is simply rates. ORS 756040, the core of the commission's authority, says that the commission shall represent customers of any public utility or communications utility and the public generally in all controversies respecting rates, valuation, service, and all matters of which the commission has jurisdiction. So this isn't a rates versus an environment issue. The PUC does renewables all the time. We do energy efficiency all the time. We consider the risk of coal plants and the extended lives all the time. So we're looking at this bill and trying to make sense of it. And frankly, we would have made our concerns known earlier had we been part of the process. We were briefed on December 22nd by the parties, didn't see a real write-up, a legal write-up until the 29th of December, and then finally on the 14th of January we saw the LC. The following day we met with the utilities and some of the other parties, including Angus, to talk through some of these issues. The utilities requested that we put some of our questions in writing, and so the following Wednesday, I think Monday was a holiday, Wednesday, we put those in writing. The commission had a informational meeting last Friday, and as a result, some of the information that we were hoping to get from the utilities hasn't arrived because the utilities were sort of preparing for that Friday informational meeting. So we're still sort of working, doing a lot on our own and waiting for additional information. All that said, I would like to sort of make three very basic points. And the goal here really, more than anything else, is to shed light on some of the statements and some of the provisions pertaining to the bill. The first point is to talk about the coal to clean provision. This is the provision that says that Oregon ratepayers will not be served by coal generation after 2030. And I think somebody really does need to say that and make this point pretty clearly, that this provision doesn't change the dispatch of the PacifiCorp coal fleet at all. The utilities will admit this. I'm assuming that PacifiCorp may come up and testify after us. And they've admitted it several times, and I think we all know it. And people have said that this coal to clean provision doesn't shut down coal plants early. It doesn't do more than that. It doesn't change the dispatch of those coal plants at all. And by not changing the coal plants, there really is no carbon reduction value in an absolute sense. So this committee and legislature sort of has to deal with the value of that policy, not as a direct impact, but as an indirect effect. And the two basic arguments on either side, and if I don't do justice to the one, I'm sure folks next to me will do me better. The one point of view is that there's a value to Oregon saying it doesn't want to be served by coal anymore. If other states join that statement, there becomes momentum and pressure on utilities, the owner of coal plants, to shut down coal facilities earlier than they otherwise would be shut down. So it is a matter of momentum and pressure. The counterargument is that the policy is sort of a mandate for leakage. Leakage is when you establish a policy to reduce carbon within your boundaries, and yet that or more amount of carbon is emitted outside of your boundaries, and you haven't really gained much. And in that sense, this that part of this bill is not good precedent. So those are the sort of non-direct effect influences, I think, that you have to balance when you consider this. And finally, on the coal to clean, I would say that while my staff is continuing to await data for from the utilities, I guess there is concern that the rate impacts that were presented to the commission on Friday understated some of those rate impacts. In particular, PacifiCorp's rate impact went to 2030. That's the analysis, and I agree completely with Senator Beyer that when you forecast, you're going to forecast wrong. The problem here is that that forecast ended in 2030, which is precisely when the it gets interesting rate-wise, when the coal plants cease serving the Oregon customers. So 2030 is a long way off. I hope to be retired but not dead by then. And it is certainly a legitimate policy objective of the state to try to remove coal from the Oregon system. I think the point we want to make here is that any analysis to justify or defend that should be legitimate. Points number two and three are a little quicker than the first one. Point number two is has to do with the renewable portfolio standard. And again, if the legislature wants to double the RPS, the PUC will implement that. It is important to understand, though, that simply doubling that number does have real impacts. The level of penetration of variable energy resources at 40-50% is something that is uncharted territory, and there will be challenges. The challenges are not insurmountable, but they do require conscious effort to address. Sort of a couple of examples of those challenges. Utilities are in the business of balancing supply and demand on a moment-to-moment basis, and variable energy resources does complicate that process. So fast and flexible generation will be needed and necessary to ensure reliable flows of power. In addition, recent studies of high levels of renewable penetration in the Northwest show that there could be periods of excess generation. That's where the renewables are generating more than the system can actually absorb. And this one study showed that a 30% regional RPS in the Northwest could result in overgeneration up to about 14%, meaning that the implication of that is it increases the per unit cost of energy. We're basically investing in resources that we can't use the entire output of. And my recollection is the commissioners on Friday asked the utilities if that overgeneration concept had been included in their analysis, and the answer was no. And finally, the reliability impacts are not currently reliably known when we get to that level of generation and renewable penetration. The commission, I think, does have a concern that the reliability off-ramp in the bill, which is only triggered by a utility, is really too narrow and should allow the commission greater latitude to consider complaints, for example, of neighboring balancing authorities that may be struggling to incorporate all that variable energy. And finally, number three. So the scope of the bill is frankly much broader than we initially had believed it was going to be. And I think, as Varner said, the bill includes several provisions related to rate making. And some of those provisions either overturn or seek to revisit commission decisions that were made in our open and, we believe, very in-depth process. And, of course, that is anybody's right to come to the legislature and ask for that. It seemed unusual to incorporate some of that in a larger omnibus bill such as this. And these are pretty complicated issues, issues I don't think you necessarily want me to describe. Issues dealing with the expiration of production tax credits and how they get incorporated into rates, the recovery of variable cost of renewable resources, and the terminal value of resources in competitive bidding processes. And all of these are issues that the Commission relatively recently addressed. If handled differently, they would tend to shift risk or protect the utility from competitive pressures. But really the point is that the provisions are either dictating different outcomes or dictating reruns. Maybe we will see those again. And finally, the EV provision. The Commission issued an order 4 years ago allowing utilities to invest in EV infrastructure and include those investment in rates as long as customers were protected and competition was not harmed. I'm not even sure a lot of folks who were behind or supportive of this bill even knew that. And at the meeting, the informational meeting on Friday, the Commission asked the utilities if that EV section in the bill was equivalent to the outcome in the order, and the answer was yes. And after some further discussion with their attorneys, they changed the answer to no, but they were not prepared actually to tell us how it was different. There are findings, legislative findings in that provision, which are very broad, and generally findings are not legally operable. But in this case, there's further language that says that the Commission must look at rate recovery for EV installation consistent with those findings, which include things like the value of attracting private capital and creating high-quality jobs in the transportation sector, and whether that goes into electric customer rates. So in summary, I think there are issues that we don't still quite understand. I'd love to tell you that we know exactly what the cost of this is going to be. I can't do that. And in our mind, there's still thinking and discussion that is probably worth having. So with that, I'll pass it on or take questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Angus Duncan. I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. I chair Oregon's Global Warming Commission, and I participated in negotiating this agreement. I'm going to leave questions of rate impact and scope to Pacific and PGE. I think that's their discussion with the PUC, and focus my testimony on the carbon reduction effects of the bill with respect to Oregon's greenhouse gas goals and with respect to overall net emissions effects. So we are all working on the same baseline. We note that about a third of Oregon's emissions come from the electricity sector. Of that, 25% of Oregon's overall emissions come just from the coal component of the electricity sector. So that's fully a quarter of the emissions that Oregon needs to work back in order to meet its greenhouse gas goals. And, of course, most of that coal is within Pacific and PGE territory. So the problem we were facing is, as a commission and as a state, is how do we ramp out of that coal? How, in doing that, do we avoid rate shock? How do we take advantage of the rather startling decline in renewable energy costs and existing federal tax credits? How do we avoid committing to new baseload gas, with the emissions associated with new baseload gas, and with the regulatory risk of stranded cost of that new gas? And how do we achieve overall greenhouse gas reductions, not just displace them? House Bill 4036, under it, the electric utility sector of Oregon meets a proportionate share of Oregon's 2035 goal. At least our analysis says that they do, and that they are then on a trajectory which makes it at least likely that they could meet our 2050 goal, always bearing in mind Senator Byers' admonitions about projecting out past 5 years. The renewable portfolio standard increase in the bill leverages near-term cost-effective wind and solar, and it positions Oregon to also leverage what we expect will be significant post-2030 cost-effective renewable energy and storage. There are certainly integration questions and integration challenges, as there are to any electricity future that we can imagine out there. But there also is very substantial change in the kinds of technologies and system management practices that are going to be available to our utilities in the future that have not in the past. You know, historically, someone at the Dittmer Control Center picked up the phone, called Grand Coulee Dam, and said, "Better crank up another generator because the loads are going up this morning." I exaggerate only slightly, because that's the way it used to be done. We have much more sophisticated ways of managing both load variability, which is enormous but predictable, and resource variability, which is going to be, which has always been substantial because of our hydro component, but which is going to be increasingly challenging with variable resources like wind and solar. On the other hand, we are going to have available to us, not just a much larger energy imbalance market, which we are anticipating will manage, for example, some of those overgeneration issues that Jason addressed. We are going to have gas integration units, the fast ramping kind of gas, rather than baseload gas. We're going to have new storage technologies. We are going to have increasing capability of predicting the output of wind and solar further into the future, not just the next minute or the next hour, but the next week or 2 weeks. And we are increasingly going to have demand response capabilities on the customer side of the meter, the ability to, in effect, manage the load in order to compensate for changes in variability of the system. So, where historically we managed our electrical system relying on a series of baseload units and peaking units, the future is very clearly going to be a system that has a wide variety of different both management and generation capabilities, and the ability to move back and forth from one to the other in order to keep the system in balance. It would be, as much of a mistake to not assume there will be significant changes in the future and to look at some of the cost and technology development curves as it would be to simply assume away the kind of integration challenges that we know we're going to have. The two, I think, most important carbon reduction measures in this bill are in some respects not even specifically in the bill, but they are implicit in the bill. One is the fact that when we back out coal generation serving Oregon loads, we could either replace it with baseload gas or we could replace it with renewables and integrating gas. And if we have a renewable portfolio standard of the sort described to you, then we will replace it with renewables and integrating gas and other integrating technologies. That means we will not simply replace coal emissions in our inventory with gas emissions in our inventory, or at least not nearly the scale we would if we were simply switching from baseload coal to baseload gas. The second significant shift in carbon, in our carbon future, comes not in the utility sector at all, but in the transportation sector, which is about 39% of our emissions based on the latest inventory. Of that, about 25% of our overall emissions come from light-duty vehicles, the cars we drive, you know, the light-duty trucks, the delivery vans. Most of what you see on the highway equals about 25% of our emissions. When the State Department of Transportation went through its extensive analysis to develop a sustainable transportation strategy, keyed to trying to meet our 2050 goals in transportation, we were able to do that with light-duty vehicles, but only if the fleet substantially electrified, you know, meaning something like 50% of the fleet was electric by 2050, and something like 80 to 90% of the new vehicles coming into the fleet in 2050 were electric. And this is the really important and we weren't plugging those cars into the sides of coal plants. We were plugging them into an electrical system that was also meeting Oregon's greenhouse gas goals. If we could do that, then we met our transportation goals, at least for light-duty trucks and vehicles, 25% of our emissions. You know, I appreciate the argument of the Public Utility Commission that not just that this won't close any coal plants, but it won't, you know, essentially change the dispatch of those coal plants. I think that's not quite right. It will redispatch the coal plants, but it won't necessarily put any less coal in the system, at least conceptually. And what Oregon does by backing out coal from its system does not substantially change those Pacific Core redispatch options directly. It's clear that the Clean Power Plan of EPA is going to dwarf anything that we can do as a state to back down coal, and it is going to have that effect. But we also know, for example, that in the state of California, when California utilities have elected to divest their shares of coal plants that are outside the state and delivering into the state, that by and large, units at those coal plants shut down in approximate proportion to the divestment of the utilities. That was true with the COUs at San. I know. I'm running out.
Yeah.
But I do want to at least address this argument. It is equally true that as Puget Energy is negotiating an exit from, you know, its share of the coal strip plants in Montana, it is likelier than not that at least two of those coal plants will close down as a result. It's clear that the more renewable energy we have on the system within the WEC, the lower the carbon intensity of that system, because the renewable energy projects with their low marginal costs will dispatch first if there is a call for additional energy.
Okay. Thank you, Angus.
Okay. And I won't try to answer Representative Bence's question, but I hope he asks it again.
All right, Jeff. And then we do have one panel that I want to get in. We have three folks who look like they're here from 100 miles away.
All right. I'll keep it very short and sweet for the record. My name is Jeff Allen. I'm executive director of Drive Oregon. We're a nonprofit trade association focused on accelerating growth of the electric vehicle industry. We have about 100 members. And we are here to testify in strong support of this measure, and particularly the transportation electrification element. And I realize that's a relatively small piece of the bill, but it's one that's very important to our industry. I've submitted as well in the record a sign-on letter with support from about 20 of our members, including companies that make vehicles like Honda, companies that provide charging, and others. So to keep it very short and sweet, I would say having utilities engaged is very important to our industry. It's one of the things we've learned over the last 4 or 5 years since the commission order was issued. There was a lot of concern early on when these cars were just coming out about what the market was going to look like. And I think there's now a pretty clear consensus that we need a partnership between the automakers, the charging providers, and the utilities to move this market forward. I will say that while we can let the lawyers argue about what the commission ruling does and doesn't say in practical terms for the last 4 years, the people we work with the utilities have not felt like they had clear authority, support, empowerment, much less direction to engage actively in the charging market. So this provision would clearly change that. It would clearly state that transportation electrification is a priority for the state, and it's key to meeting our carbon goals, both of which are true but worthy of restatement. A couple of other quick points. Utility engagement is important for the market overall. It's particularly important for low-income communities, people who live in apartment buildings. Basically, the most difficult to serve folks who are the ones with the longest payback periods or the ones who are going to be last served if we just leave this to the market entirely. It's also going to be good for utility customers. We've already heard a little bit about if you're generating excess power, where is that going to go? Electric vehicles are a great source of basically dispatchable demand, if you will, that you can vary the rate of charging based on when there's excess renewable energy. They provide a shock absorber on the system. And we feel that the legislation as drafted preserves a really important role for the Public Utility Commission to review and provide some oversight to those proposals that come in from the utilities, make sure that they are preserving a competitive marketplace for charging, that they are serving those difficult to reach and low-income communities and not just taking the easy markets to serve, and that it's going to provide those benefits to ratepayers in the real world and not just in theory. And I submitted several pages of testimony, happy to answer questions, but in interest of time, I'll stop there.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go ahead and bring up the panel of folks who have come from 100 miles away, and then we could bring these guys back up in a second. Thank you. So that I have Brian Seekin, Mike MacArthur, and Carrie Thompson. And if anyone else has come from over 100 miles, please feel free to come up as well.
Madam Chair, Mike MacArthur, Association of Oregon Counties. We have submitted testimony, our county governments, in support of the concept of this legislation with a caveat. And I can come back and tell you more about that and tell you the long story later. I'll let these gentlemen speak.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Skane. I'm the director of the Community Renewable Energy Association. CREA is a ORS 190 intergovernmental organization comprised of 13 counties, two irrigation districts, along with affiliate membership of the Oregon Water Resource Council or Congress, small private project developers, supporters of small non-utility developed energy projects. My testimony today is also supported by the Renewable Energy Coalition, which represents 32 members who own 41 small energy projects, primarily small hydroelectric projects of less than 7 megawatts, and a handful of biomass projects across 7 states. CREA supports the passage of HB 4036 with amendments, as Mike MacArthur just mentioned. We believe that 4036 answers or asks the right questions, which is, should Oregon transition away from generated electricity from coal? And if it is going to move away from that, how should that be replaced? And we think that those are the right questions to ask, and we think that this bill provides the right answers to those questions. As Portland General, I think, properly pointed out, the status quo isn't really a viable option. The cheapest thing to do is keep that 87 Corolla going as long as you can, but at some point in time, you need to move forward. And as I think Werner correctly pointed out, some of these coal projects are getting very old. In some cases, utilities are losing existing contracts. So the question is not, are you able to continue to do what you've always done forever, but how do you move forward? And this bill provides a sound basis of planning and policy direction from the legislature to move forward in a way that, based on utilities analysis and based on other people's analysis that corroborate that, it appeared to be affordable for Oregon ratepayers. We do believe, however, that the bill as drafted does have one omission that we're concerned about. As noted, I represent people who develop and support small, distributed community generation. And we support an amendment that takes the existing language of Oregon's RPS, which created a goal of 8% of Oregon's load to be provided by these small 20-megawatt and smaller community projects, to turn that goal into a mandate as applies to investor-owned utility load. We believe that the cost implications of that are fairly insignificant. We think that there has been demonstrated ability to make that work already under the current RPS. We believe that Unfortunately, though, we are not on track to meet that goal right now, and turning that goal into a mandate will assure that there is the ability for small, non-utility, private and community generation to compete fairly, to provide generation under the provisions of where this bill would take us. And we think that that provides good economic benefits for rural communities in Oregon. Oregon State University in Minnesota, the National Renewable Energy Labs have all done studies that indicate that the economic benefits for these small community-based projects tend to be greater in local communities than, you know, the larger utility-based projects. And we believe that Oregon would be unwise to not try to capture those economic benefits as it contemplates the next, 35 years of our energy future under HB 4036. So we know we're in a time constraint. I'll close my comments there and be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name is Gary Thompson. I'm Sherman County Judge, home of significant renewable energy in excess of 1,000 megawatts being produced within my county. I agree that some of them are fairly ugly to look at, but we really enjoy the financial benefits that the county receives.
It looks like money to Gary.
Yes. It's, as one of my local farmers says, I hate to look at those windmills, but ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. Every time one of them goes around, she smiles and goes south for the winter. I'm here in support of House Bill 4036 with a caveat. The problem, there's one major flaw with it, is that there is no guarantee that any renewables will be built in Oregon. That's the major flaw of the whole thing. Unless we can get some type of a amendment to put at least some of that, a percentage of that power to be manufactured in Oregon. The amendment is the easy way for the legislature to create a clean, substantial economic development in rural Oregon. And that's an easy way of doing it, is an amendment to the bill. With that, if there's any questions, I'll pass it on to Mike MacArthur.
And Mr. MacArthur, do you mind switching out? I believe we have one more person who is here to testify from 100 miles away. Thank you.
You go ahead.
I'm on.
Okay. Irene Gilbert, 2310 Adams Avenue, La Grande, Oregon. Thank you, Chairman Vega Peterson and the rest of the committee. I'm not even going to try to be organized here, but I do have some comments that I did want to share, and I provided you with some things in writing, so I won't repeat a bunch of that. But I did want to note that there are 12 states with populations 12 states have less population than Oregon, and more CO2 is being generated. And every state with less CO2 emissions have less population than Oregon. So we are doing a good job with CO2 emissions right now. Oregon has 1.24% of the U.S. population, and we generate 0.68% of the total emissions. I think that's something that's worth noting. Also, I think it's worth noting, and I provided this in written testimony, that the states that have a better rate in terms of generation of pollutants also have significant higher electric costs than Oregon. And those figures are taken directly from the Department of U.S. Department of Energy, and I can provide you the information that I took that from. One thing that I find of concern is, there are several things that I find concern with this, is the fact that, number one, it talks about the fact that The consumers in Oregon will be charged up to 4% more than the cost of reducing, either developing or purchasing energy from other sources. And that's in conflict with a federal law that says that it can't be more than the cost. And I can probably find that reference really quickly for you. But there is a federal ruling, and I got that from some information from Idaho Power, that you cannot have 4% above the cost of replacing energy from some other source. The other thing that concerns me is the land use that's being used in order to meet these renewable energy standards. And according to information from the American Wind Energy Association, don't be looking at what I provided you because this is different information. They used a production factor of 90% and said that if wind and solar were producing 90% efficiency, it would take the average amount of acreage of land for a per megawatt would be 60 acres of land. Now, Oregon currently has over 3,000 megawatts of wind energy. We have a huge amount of our state in terms of land that's currently devoted to this. And there are impacts when you use land. I realize that some of the developers that have these on their land are happy to receive the money. But I can tell you that of a 300-megawatt facility that's Klondike 2 wind project, which is covering thousands of acres of land, the amount of mitigation for habitat damages to that is 44 acres. So the citizens of Oregon are suffering significant impacts to our interest in wildlife habitat the more of these you build.
And Ms. Gilbert, thank you so much. We're about out of time, but thank you very much for
coming. I have a whole bunch more as far as...
And if you can submit that in writing to us, we're happy to post it to OLIS.
Okay, can I tell you one thing about costs that Idaho Power just did wind, a couple of wind energy contracts. They
If you can submit that on OLIS, we'll make sure that we get it posted.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
It's like twice as much that they're paying.
Thank you so much. And I apologize for this. We're just already over time, and I know things that people have things to get to. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask Angus and Jason to come back for questions on Thursday. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4036 and close the committee hearing.